Here now with his talk, Systems Biology, Emerging Technologies from Reactive to Proactive Medicine, Dr. Leroy Hood.
Thanks, sir. Well, it's a pleasure to be here tonight and discuss my vision of where I see medicine going in the future. I'll argue that this new medicine, which I call P4 medicine, and the four P's are listed here, we'll discuss them later, is not just going to be an incremental change, but really a fundamentally revolutionary change. And the essence of that change is that biology, for the first time, will become a deep informational science. And in fact, it's the systems approaches to disease, it's the emerging technologies that are leading this revolution. And my projection is that 10 years in the future, every single patient will be surrounded by a virtual cloud of billions of data points, and we'll have the wherewithal to be able to reduce that enormous data dimensionality to simple hypotheses about health and disease. And why do we need so much data? We need it because of the enormous complexity of the human organism, and we'll talk in a moment about where that complexity comes from. In essence, it comes from evolution. What you can see is there will be very different types of data present in that virtual cloud of information 10 years in the future, from molecular and cellular up to social data. And the integration of all of those types of data will give us these deep and fundamental insights. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about complexity and paradigm changes that have occurred in biology over the last 30 or so years. And then we'll talk about the science and technology of P4 medicine, of systems medicine. And then finally, I'll talk about the implications for the individual and the implications for society of this new medicine. With regard to complexity, I'm struck as we now move in the first decade of the 21st century that the grand challenge for all scientific disciplines, in a sense, is complexity. And the complexities of these different science and engineering disciplines are quite different one from another. I think in many ways what makes biology truly unique is that we have powerful ways of attacking that complexity. And these really are the four pillars of what I'm going to talk about tonight. This view that medicine is really becoming an informational science, the idea that we have to take a systems approach to disease, that is a holistic view of disease, rather than, as we've in the past, looked at bits and pieces of the disease, the idea that there are new emerging technologies that will allow us to explore completely new dimensions of patient data space, and of course, we have to develop the analytic tools to be able to deal with this enormous amount of information. These integrated, powerful capacities, interestingly enough, give biology then the power to attack some of the most fundamental problems in society today. So I'll talk primarily about healthcare and how we can use those tools to approach it. But if we think about global medicine or agriculture or the environment or bioenergy or nutrition or animal health, all of these large, challenging problems can be attacked in ways that are exactly analogous to what I'll discuss tonight. And hence, it puts, I think, biology in a unique position to solve some of society's most fundamental problems. The core of this medicine is centered in the idea that it is evolved from a series of interesting paradigm changes. I remember as a young assistant professor in the early 70s at Caltech, I read this book by Thomas Kuhn, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and it had an enormous impact on my thinking. And basically what it said is that as science progresses, there accumulates difficulties with current dogmas that reach a tipping point and a dramatic change, a dramatic paradigm change actually occurs. And he also pointed out clearly that affecting paradigm changes is not at all an easy kind of thing. So in my career over the past 40 years or so, I've been involved in a series of five paradigm changes, and they, four of these paradigm changes form the basis, the framework for thinking about the fifth, which is this thing called P4 medicine. So initially when I went to Caltech, I had the idea that I'd spend half of my time doing biology and half of my time developing new types of technologies. And as you heard, we developed a series of instruments that really have transformed how biology was practiced. But what was really important at that time back in 1973 was that I was really focused on creating instruments that could decipher various types of biological information. And at that time, we knew the genome was the basic source code of information for life, and we'll talk more about that in just a few moments. And we knew that the genome was quantized in the sense that its individual units of information were genes that manifest themselves first through a related kind of four-letter nucleic acid called RNA, and then ultimately that got translated into proteins with their complicated 20-letter language, and it's these proteins that can fold in many different shapes to create the molecular machines of life. So I was really interested in seeing whether we could generate instruments that looked at DNA, at RNA, and at proteins. And in fact, over a period of time, we developed four instruments at Caltech and one instrument at the University of Washington, where I moved in 1992. And all of these did just exactly what I talked about. And in fact, one of them, the automated DNA sequencer, enabled the Human Genome Project, and we'll talk more about that again in just a few moments. The early commitment I had about creating new knowledge, new information, was that it was really critical that it be dispensed out to society in effective ways. So I actually created a company called Applied Biosystems that commercialized the first four instruments, and then another existing company, Agilent, commercialized the fifth of these instruments. And I think the idea that you can effectively transfer knowledge to society ought to be one of the major objectives of academia. I will say it was met with enormous scorn. I remember talking with the president of Caltech when I was thinking about starting my first company to commercialize the first four of these instruments. And he gave me a stern speech about the role of academics is scholarship and education. It's not commercialization. And I said, that's the wrong way to look at it. It's transferring knowledge to society. Anyway, he said, you go figure out how to do that. Caltech was not interested in commercialization. I will say Caltech has turned 180 degrees since that, that point of time. And you can all guess what was the focal point of that change. Now, the second paradigm change that I was involved in was the Human Genome Project. As a consequence of developing automated DNA sequencing, I got invited in the spring of 1985 to the first meeting ever held on the Human Genome Project. This was at Santa Cruz. The Chancellor, Robert Sinsheimer, was thinking about creating an institute to sequence the genome. So he invited 12 experts from around the world to come and debate this topic. We did so for 2 days, and we came to two really interesting conclusions. One was that it was possible, although technically challenging. And number two, it was interesting to see that the 12 of us were split 6-6, and those opposed to the Genome Project were fanatically opposed. And indeed, in the mid-80s, when I went out to the community to start advocating for the Human Genome Project, I would say 90% of the biologists were opposed to it, based on a variety of doctrinaire grounds. Big science is bad. The genome is mostly junk. Why should we sequence it? And all of those arguments were wrong. And at the time, I was able to give good arguments as to why those arguments were wrong, but people weren't able to hear them. And again, it's an example of paradigm changes take a while for most people to get used to. But as we know, the Genome Project was successfully initiated in 1990 and concluded some 13 years later. At least the first phase of the Genome Project was concluded. But what is this genome exactly? It is the raw material that makes up the information storage system, that is your chromosomes that are present in each and every one of the cells. And the chromosomes have these linear strands of the four-letter language of DNA, and the chromosomes range in size from 270 million letters of DNA language to about 60 or 70 letters of the DNA language. And in fact, to give you an idea of how much DNA is present in a human body, you've got about 6 meters in each one of your 10 to the 14 cells, and that means your DNA could stretch to the sun and back again some 2,000 times. So it's a remarkable problem of compaction to compact that information down to where it fits in cells that are smaller than the dot of a pencil. A remarkable feat, obviously, in engineering. What I'll tell you about in the Genome Project was initiated by an article a science writer at the New York Times, Nicholas Wade, wrote about 3 months ago in the New York Times, and he was complaining about how the Genome Project had really failed in its promise. And I would argue, quite to the contrary, the Genome Project has spectacularly transformed biology, and I can give you a whole series of examples of what it did. First, it gave us a complete parts list of all genes, and that was fundamentally necessary to begin taking the systems approach that we'll talk about later in this lecture. I started thinking about systems biology in the early 80s, but I realized that, one, we needed better technologies to to identify biological information, analyze it, and two, we needed the complete parts list before we could really do it. Point number two is the Genome Project democratized genes. That is, it made every gene available to every biologist by relatively simple procedures and so forth. Number three, what it did is it catalyzed the initiation of a whole series of technologies that have just revolutionized biology. High throughput, intensely parallel, the ability to generate enormous amounts of information. And I'll give you a later example of what's happened with the automated DNA sequencer. It also enabled a field called proteomics, which lets us analyze the proteins present in cells or organs or indeed whole organisms, and it does so by analyzing them with mass spectrometry-based techniques. A fifth thing that the Genome Project did, it was the first time that we really effectively brought in computer scientists, mathematicians, theoretical physicists to biology, and they had a real substrate to work on. And in fact, that has transformed our field by making it cross-disciplinary in marvelously extending ways and so forth. The Genome Project did more. It was the first project in biology that advocated open data immediately available to the community upon generating the information. A revolutionary idea, but fortunately it was an idea pushed by the funding agencies, so it took hold very quickly. And of course, we also had the idea of data quality. For the first time in biology, there were standards, and if your sequencing didn't meet the standards, you weren't part of the Human Genome Project, and you very quickly lost your grants and so forth. It also gave us access to the genomes of plants, of animals, and of microbes, and this has in many, many ways transformed the field of biology. we could give a whole lecture on what the genome has done in that regard. And it has absolutely transformed our understanding of evolution. And we'll talk in just a moment about one of the really interesting aspects that has come out in that regard. It has changed medicine, number one. It's given us a new field of medical diagnostics that lets us make predictions about disease in really interesting ways. Number two, we're actually using genome analyses of tumors to indicate which therapy is appropriate for the individual patient. And number four, it's introduced the world of this personalized medicine, so-called P4 medicine that I'll be talking about. But as well, it's changed the sociology of science. It really has us now debating big as opposed to small science. I was just on a National Academy committee that was looking into big and small science back in Washington about a month ago now. And I'm going to talk about that later and some of the implications of what that means for biology anyway. It's also that this was one of the first projects where we spent 5% of the budget on thinking about the social issues that the Genome Project actually imposed. And the final point I would make is the Human Genome Project has given us deep insights into ourselves. And one of the most interesting insights is there are no race-specific genes. And that says we are one species, and that has interesting implications that I'll talk about on the very last slide. So that was two paradigm changes. That was engineering and the Genome Project. The third paradigm change I participated in was cross-disciplinary biology. And the idea here is when we developed the automated sequencer, we failed for the first 3 years because I had a very smart biologist work on it, but he didn't have the depth either in chemistry or in engineering to really be able to develop that instrument. And within 6 weeks of putting together a team of people that covered all of those skills plus computer science, we had formulated the strategy that eventually was realized in a prototype instrument in 1986. And that made me realize that we had to bring in all of these other flavors of scientists to biology. And I proposed again to a different president at Caltech that I start a cross-disciplinary biology department at Caltech. And the chemists and engineers were really in favor of this. The physicists, I think, were largely indifferent. And the biologists were bitterly opposed. And why that was is really, again, interesting sociology. But fortunately, Bill Gates made it possible for me to move to the University of Washington and start a department which, in its 8 years of existence, was marvelously successful in starting whole new fields of biology. What happened, interestingly enough, is I had a commitment from the dean that hired me to build, on top of the cross-disciplinary department, a systems biology aspect of it. And the dean died in an avalanche in the Himalayas. Serendipity reared its head. And the new dean had a very different view of what was important in biology and medicine. So in 2000, I resigned from the University of Washington to set up a nonprofit research institute that was dedicated to systems biology. I will say in retrospect that the bureaucracy of a state university would have made it virtually impossible to be successful in this endeavor because bureaucracies are honed by the past and almost never can they deal effectively with the future. And that's true of big institutions, and it's unfortunately true of small institutions as well. And you'll come to see how all four of these paradigm changes led to the fifth paradigm change, which is going to be the focus of much of this lecture, that is P4 medicine. So I'll make just a couple of comments about these paradigm changes. One is that they really did change how we think in major ways about biology, each in their own ways. Number two, there was enormous resistance in every single case to these paradigm changes at the beginning, and on average, it took 10 years to gain or more to gain acceptance. And number three, what was really interesting, and this does say a lot about institutions, is in every one of these cases, we had to create new organizational institutions to realize the potential of the paradigm change. And we'll talk again at the end of the lecture a little bit more about that. So, as I said earlier in talking about complexity, the four pillars, if you will, of systems biology and FP4 medicine are these: the informational view of medicine, the systems approach to disease, the emerging technologies, and finally the appropriate analytic tools. So let me talk about two or three of these. And we'll begin by talking about biology as an informational science, because this is a relatively new idea. And one of the challenges in biology for most people that come in from the outside is to realize the true nature and the true extent of its complexity. And again, that complexity arises from Darwinian evolution. Darwinian evolution is not a directed force, but rather it operates in the context of given environments to use random mutation to fashion solutions to problems that need to be answered immediately. And that means Darwinian evolution builds on past successes, but it doesn't do it in a rational way. And in fact, to give you a beautiful example of this, there are a type of insect called stick insects that have evolved and lost and evolved and lost their wings three different times. And with each change in state, there is embedded in the genome information that told us about the preceding states. So now when you look at stick insects, they have a lot of complexity in the machinery that has to do with the development of wings and things like that. And again, it's because of Darwinian evolution. And in fact, it reminds me a lot of Rube Goldberg devices. So here's a Rube Goldberg device that uses 14 different operations to cool his soup so he can drink it appropriately. And in a sense, evolution does that for biology. So what it means is people who think they can from on high theoretically analyze biological problems and make deep predictions about them are going to always turn out to be wrong, because the complexity is far greater. We do not use the law of Occam's razor or the simplest solution to a problem in biology. Another fundamental informational key is that biology has hierarchical levels of modularity. And it's very much like Legos. If you take a simple Lego block, you can build higher level structures and yet even higher level structures. And in biology, if you come to look to understand those primitive modules, they give you deep and fundamental insights into the more complicated hierarchic structures from which they can be devised. And that's true in the sense of being able to look at the structure of things, and it's true in being able to deal with information and the circuitry of dealing with information. So this idea of modularity is really a key point in biology. Now, a really critical question from an informational point of view in biology is this idea of what are the types of information that biological organisms actually employ? And it turns out that there are two. One is the digital information that's encoded in your genome, and the second is information that comes from the outside environment. And within the organism, these two types of information collide, and they create the fundamental processes of life. So evolution, development, physiologic responses, and the initiation and progression of disease. So we have to understand then, how is it that those two types of information can be integrated and fused together to create these very complex aspects of phenotype, both normal and diseased? And the answer is that there are two types of molecular machines, if you will, that mediate this process. So the first is called biological networks, and they capture and transmit and mine and integrate and finally pass the information off to simple and complex molecular machines. To a large part, those are made up of proteins, and they actually execute the functions of life. And the boundaries between the network and the molecular machines are often quite fuzzy. So what systems medicine and systems biology are about is understanding the dynamics by which those entities operate to convert digital and environmental information into phenotype. And I'll show you very briefly an example of how we've begun to approach that. And to give you an example of the extremes, in all diseases, you can ask the question, is the disease primarily genetic or is it primarily environmental? And there are extremes, diseases that are almost entirely genetic, diseases that are like infections that are almost entirely environmental. But for more complex diseases, the answers lie somewhere in between. And how we make the assessment about relative contributions is still a challenging question today. And it leads us to an interesting area that we may talk just briefly about called a new area of biology called systems genetics. But what you're seeing on the slide here are the left index fingerprints of two identical twin girls. And what you can see is the fingerprints are completely different from one another in spite of the fact their genes are absolutely identical. So this means that the environment, whether operating through stochastic events in the unfolding of the fingerprint programs or other events in the environment, has led to these marked differences. And even today, we don't have any idea what the real answer is. The final point I'll make about biology as an informational science is that we have to realize that biological information is multi-scale and hierarchical, and it goes from DNA to RNA to proteins to networks and cells and tissues and individuals all the way up to populations and ecology. And what is important to realize is the environment impinges upon the basic digitalization of the source code at each and every one of those levels. Hence, if we're truly to understand a complex biological system, we have to acquire the information at each of those levels and carry out a process of integration which does nothing more than explicate the different types of environmental information that have been summed together to give you the final product of the system's operation. And again, that is an enormous computational mathematical challenge in contemporary systems medicine, P4 medicine. What about the second point, taking this systems or this holistic approach toward disease? How do we actually go about doing that? And this gets us to the fundamental question of what exactly is systems biology and how might an engineer think about systems biology? And the analogy of how a radio converts radio waves into sound waves, I think, is a good one. So if you were an engineer, you might take the radio apart and assess its individual components to understand what they did. This is exactly what biology has done for the last 40 years, studying individual genes and individual components. But you know well that if you only studied the components, you wouldn't have a chance of understanding how the radio did that conversion. And exactly the same is true of biology. What the Genome Project did was, for the first time, give us this complete parts list so we can look at everything. Now, the second thing you'd do if you wanted to understand how the radio worked is you'd put these components together in their circuits and try and understand how the circuits individually and collectively carried out this transform of electromagnetic waves into sound waves. And exactly the same is done in living organisms. Whether it's looking at health and its phenotypic responses, or disease and its responses. Those responses are mediated by biological circuits and by molecular machines, and we have to understand the dynamics of those things if we're to ever understand the systems characteristics of health and disease. What is important to stress is that systems biology can only thrive in the context of a cross-disciplinary environment. And that's critical because the really fundamental point is the frontier problems of biology should always drive and dictate which tools you will develop, and those tools in turn and the data they generate should drive and dictate which computational and mathematical tools we need. So it is the biology that is the driver, but we need this whole cross-disciplinary cadre of scientists to be able to execute the technology and the development of new analytic tools, as well as its explication to understanding exactly how biological processes work. And two fundamental issues that are new for biology, maybe much less so for physics, is one, we've at ISB learned how to speak the languages of different scientists so we can communicate effectively, and two, we've learned how to work effectively together in teams, and those are not things biologists did a lot of in the past. And in fact, what we've done is we've created at ISB a series of tools for generating information, a series of programs for analyzing information, and we can then apply that to simple or complex model systems and ultimately to human biology. And what's critical is any biologist at ISB has access to this entire array of technologies and computational tools. Now, I understand Perimeter is 10 years old. We also are 10 years old. We have about 300 staff, 12 faculty now. And as a slight digression, when you're at one of these big birth dates, it's relevant to talk about metrics of success. And I'll give you two, briefly, metrics of success for us. When I started the Institute in 2000, many of my friends were enormously skeptical as to whether systems biology was anything more than general hype. So it was with enormous interest that I noted last year the National Academy put out this report on the new biology, which was a perfect description of systems biology. And two of the people on that report were among my biggest skeptics just 10 years ago. So that's where the 10-year number about being convinced and paradigm changes come from. Now, the second metric, so that, and I might point out that there are more than 70 institutes, centers, departments of systems biology across the world, and they obviously come in many different flavors. But the second metric is a personal metric for ISB. A Spanish institute some years ago developed a new metric for assessing the impact of individual papers and then averaging the impact of all the papers that Institute had done across a five-year period, and went out and looked at 2,200 research institutes across the world. And it was interesting to note that ISB came in by this metric first in the US and third in the world, and the high impact papers that we had were in biology, in medicine, in technology, and in mathematics and computer science. So it's a validation for the power of this cross-disciplinary environment. How do we think about disease from a systems point of view? The idea there is disease arises in the relevant organ as a consequence of biological networks that become disease perturbed either genetically and or environmentally. That alters the envelope of information they express, and in one case we've studied in some detail, we can say unequivocally that altered envelope of information explains virtually entirely the pathophysiology, the molecular cellular basis of the disease, and it gives us completely new insights into diagnosis, into therapy, and ultimately into prevention. And the system that we looked at was studying neurodegeneration in a mouse that was induced by an infectious protein particle. And we did this because we could time the onset of the disease and then look at multiple time points across the onset of disease to analyze what's happening in the brain of mice. And what we did was, after infecting a subset of mice, we also analyzed their normal counterparts, and we subtracted the changes that occurred in the brain from one another. So we ended up looking only at the things that changed in the course of these things. And to our horror, almost a third of the genes in the mouse changed in this process. But we were actually able to figure out very powerful techniques for dealing with the two major types of noise we have to face in biology. One is kind of technical noise, and that's about statistics and understanding how machines work. But the other, much more complicated, was biological noise. And what that means is, if you look at any particular aspect of a mouse brain, when you measure it, it sums up a whole series of different unique biologies. If you're only interested in the genes involved in neurodegeneration, we have to subtract away all of those biologies. And when we did so, we were able to subtract that away to end up with about 300 genes that encoded this neurodegenerative response. And what we were able to do is use the well-known histopathology of this disease to identify four major biological networks, and then we displayed those 300 genes in the context of those four different biological networks. And we were able to make a series of fascinating observations. One was that the four networks became sequentially disease-perturbed, and that the proximal disease-perturbed network was really the key one to focus on for diagnosis and therapy, because it was the only unique one. The three downstream networks were seen in human and mouse neurodegenerative diseases of all different types. Point number two that was really fascinating is, when we looked at these biological networks, and the red indicates where the relevant genes are changed in the disease as compared with the normal animals, we could understand a whole series of things. One, virtually every aspect of the pathophysiology of that disease could be understood. And in fact, two, because we did a global analysis, we identified not just the four major networks, but six smaller ones that were really important in the disease process that heretofore had been completely unknown. And finally, it gave us really interesting new insights into therapy and diagnosis. So in therapy, one of the questions is, can we take this proximal network and can we design drugs that will operate on that network to re-engineer it and make it behave in a normal way? And we're attempting to study these approaches in very simple model systems. But number two, we had a diagnostic that actually is going to make blood a window into distinguishing health from disease. And the basic idea was as follows. We can identify in each one of your 50 organs unique genes that are only or mostly only expressed in that organ. Some of those organ-specific genes actually make proteins that get secreted in the blood. So for example, for the brain, we now have 110 proteins that are brain-specific and we see in the blood. So the really important point is, if you have a normal brain, the levels of those 110 proteins will be set at one series of concentrations. But if you have a disease in the brain, those proteins whose cognate networks become disease-perturbed will alter their levels. And because each disease uses different combinations of disease-perturbed networks, it will define a unique fingerprint that will separate, distinguish health from disease in each different type of disease. And we've actually shown this in a whole series of studies and model systems. And what this has been able to let us do is make blood truly a window into health and disease. So we can do early detection. We can take a disease and stratify it into its different types from the blood. For example, breast cancer is at least 5 different types of diseases. And unless you can stratify it, you don't know which drugs will work and which drugs will fail. And I'll give you an example of that a little bit later. We can follow disease progression, and we can obviously follow treatment and reoccurrence. And in fact, about a year and a half ago, I started a company called Integrated Diagnostics that employs all of these techniques. And I think it's going to make an enormous impact on this world of P4 medicine by creating a diagnostic platform that will let us do each of the things that we've talked about here. What about new technologies? Well, let me begin by starting just describing very briefly 4 major projects at my institute that are all technology driven. One is the idea that all sequencing of human genomes in the future should be done in families, because this lets us integrate genetics and genomics in a way that enables us to do incredible things. And I'm going to tell you what some of those incredible things are in just a moment. Number 2, because our institute has created 4 technologies and/or computational tools that are uniquely powerful, we're now driving the idea that we can have a human proteome project utterly analogous and parallel to the Human Genome Project. I was just at a meeting in Washington, D.C., trying to push this point of view. And whether we'll be successful or not this year, I don't know, because of budgetary constraints, but it is the next big venture into discovery, big science. Number 3, we've developed a whole series of clinical assays which are absolutely going to transform our ability to search new dimensionalities in patient data space, and I'll give you an example or two of that. And then finally, I'm really excited about a second human genome project, so we're working with one of the world's largest data centers to set up the wherewithal to be able to capture in time the hundreds of millions of complete human genomes that are done with their attendant medical and molecular and cellular data, so we can mine that information for the predictive medicine of the future. That has enormous social barriers as well as scientific and technical barriers. But let's talk about whole genome sequencing. We sequenced a family of 4 that were interesting in that the parents were normal and the 2 kids each had 2 different genetic diseases. And in sequencing those 4 genomes, it really transformed the world of genetics and genomics in really interesting ways. Number 1, we could use the principles of Mendelian inheritance to reduce DNA sequencing errors in this family of 4 by more than 70%. And number 2, it made it dirt simple to identify just 4 genes that had to be candidates for the 2 different genetic diseases. And these were localized to chromosomes 4 and 5 and 16, and it was a very straightforward effort to identify the genes that correlated with each disease. So what we feel we can do now is any simple Mendelian order, we can find the genes in a very straightforward fashion by using family genome sequencing. Now we've just finished the sequence of 65 individuals that are from families that have Huntington's disease, and there we're looking for modifiers of the major Huntington's disease gene, because in those families, some individuals get the disease in the late 20s and others get it in the early 70s. And wouldn't it be nice if we could push it so for Huntington's disease, everybody got it in the 70s. And then we're actually going to use this to attack complex genetic diseases, which we can only do after we invent new techniques for stratifying really complex genetic diseases like Alzheimer's. I would guess that Alzheimer's is 6 to 8 to 10 different diseases. And until we can stratify those, we aren't going to be able to do the appropriate impedance match against the 130 or so drugs the pharma industry has. when they use them on the pooled collection of Alzheimer's patients, they'll never have a chance of really discovering which drugs are going to work effectively. What I think many of you can't appreciate is the enormous changes that have occurred in our capacity to do DNA sequencing. And let me give you a simple example. In the year 2000, it was estimated it costs about $300 million to do one human genome sequence. This year, we're doing one human genome sequence for $6,000. So that's a 50,000-fold reduction in the cost. And the quality of data today is far better than it was 10 years ago. So those are the exponential changes that are occurring in technology. My prediction is within a 10-year period, these genome sequences will be a common part of all of our medical records, and they'll be done in families for the reasons I've already given. And I'll show you what I think are going to be the biggest advantage of having human genome sequences in just a couple of moments. Now, what my vision of blood as a window into separating health from disease is the time when 10 to 15 years in the future, we have 50 organ-specific blood proteins for each of your 50 major organs, and we have a handheld device that can prick your thumb, take a little bit of blood, measure those 2,500 proteins, send it to a server, have them analyzed, and it'll tell you, you're fine, do it again in 6 months, or you should be worried about your kidney or your brain or something like that. And in fact, with those proteins, we'll be able to make very educated guesses as to what the nature of the pathology is. So this idea of longitudinal information that is unique to the individual, I think, will be transforming for allowing us to assess very early on when we transition from wellness actually into disease. We have, with Jim Heath, actually developed an instrument that can do 50 such protein measurements today. It operates on a fraction of a droplet of blood. It operates and carries out the analyses in less than 5 minutes, and we now have it in the clinic at UCLA, and we're beginning to test this on home studies, interestingly enough, on-site studies, being able to follow the response of patients with two types of tumor, glioblastoma and melanoma, to various drug regimens and therapy and so forth. We have developed a whole series of assays for genomics and proteomics and single cell analyses and so forth. And one of the assays I'll describe for you today, because I think it's the category that really is going to drive the human genome analysis and making them routinely a part of patient records. So I had recently a couple of human geneticists scan the literature to identify genes whose variants were actionable. That is, if we knew you had that gene, we could tell you something that would really change your life. And an example of such a gene is a blood clotting factor called Leyden factor 5. 5% of the population has this defect. It leads to deep vein thromboses, and it is particularly dangerous in pregnant women, where you increase several fold the tendency for these kinds of clots. If you know you have that gene, there are a whole series of straightforward things you can do to ensure you don't get these deep vein thromboses, up to including very mild levels of anticoagulant. And I'm saying there are 106 of these genes that we can begin to routinely look at in every single patient, and the number of those is going to absolutely increase exponentially in the future. So the informational view of medicine, the systems approaches to disease, the emerging technologies and computational tools, which I haven't talked about, all lead to this thing we call P4 medicine. And I'll give you a 10-year view of the four Ps. So in prediction, I've already said it. I think in 10 years, you'll have your genomes. we can, with just a modest amount of environmental information, use that genome information to begin making ever more accurate predictions about the future of your health trajectory. And hence, we're going to be in an unparalleled position to optimize wellness, and I'll say more about that in a minute. Number two, I think we'll have this device that can measure your 2,500 organ-specific blood proteins and give you a longitudinal record of health against disease for 50 major organ systems. The personalized side, of course, arises as a consequence of the fact that you each, on average, differ by 6 million letters of your DNA language from your neighbor. And that means each patient has to be their own control for assessing health as opposed to disease. And of course, when you have billions of data points, we'll be able to sculpt with exquisite specificity health as opposed to disease for each of you. And of course, when we have 340 million Americans and Canadians added in, if we have access to that information, we'll be able to mine for the predictive medicine of the future in an unparalleled power to, I think, change and transform medicine. The predictive side of things actually has three dimensions that I think are important. One, we have a completely new strategy for identifying drug targets, and in the future, it will be simple, inexpensive, and give us rapid access to new drugs. We can change the whole paradigm of failure that characterizes the current pharmaceutical industry. Number two, we can use systems approaches to understand the two branches of the immune system, innate and adaptive immunity, and fashion that so we can create the vaccines of the future that really need good cellular components to respond to AIDS and TB and many of the major emerging infectious diseases that plague the world today. And three, and this is the most important point, I think over this 10-year span, we're going to see an increasing focus on wellness and an optimization of wellness for the individual patients. And I'll say just a more word or two about that in the future. Now, those deal mostly with technical aspects. This participatory, the fourth P, deals with societal aspects. How do we educate patients so they can take advantage of P4 medicine? How do we convince an enormously skeptical physician population, and in fact, the entire medical community, that this revolution is going to transform how we can practice medicine? So I'll tell you what some of my thoughts are about that in just a few moments. But the other issue that is really intriguing, and certainly I'd hope to be able to talk to the founder of the Perimeter Institute about this, is the idea that the dimensionality of the IT for healthcare in the future is not even imagined by most of the biggest IT companies out there, the Microsofts and the Googles and the IBMs and so forth. And who is going to be the daring, venturesome company that can really do an IT for healthcare that can manage billions upon billions of data points for hundreds of millions of patients? And we have yet to identify that particular person. The participatory we've already discussed. Actually, I should go back and tell you a little bit about the slide that I did miss. And that is a beautiful example of stratification and of personalized medicine. As I said, there are probably five or more different subtypes of breast cancer. And one of those subtypes is characterized by the amplification of a particular gene that can readily be identified by DNA analyses. And this is seen in maybe 20 to 30% of the women patients. Genentech devised a drug that operates in the context of that knowledge, and it has had spectacular results on the stratified population of women with this particular defect. But it's had spectacular results for the first year or so, and then the women become resistant to even that drug. So in the future, a fundamental idea of all cancer therapies has to be that we'll use two or even three drugs from the very first day, just as we use three drugs for AIDS to be able to deal with a high mutation rate of the vector in that case. And here we have to deal with a high mutation rate of the cancer itself. So this shows us the power of stratification and of being able to target the drug for the right individual. So let me tell you four social consequences of P4 medicine. One, in 10 years, I'd argue every single sector of the healthcare industry will have to fundamentally rewrite their business plan. And I think one of the really interesting questions is going to be whether old companies can take on new ideas and adapt to them really effectively. And we're certainly going to find out in this particular case. And I think that's really going to be true of the drug companies. Number two, it is clear that P4 medicine is going to lead to a digitalization of medicine that has actually three interesting different dimensions. So one is the idea that we will, in the not too distant future, from a single molecule, a single genome, or a single cell, be able to gain actionable information for the patient about disease. Number two is the really interesting idea that we will have hundreds of billions of data points that we have to deal with effectively. And number three is the idea, I think, in a 5 to 10 year period in the future, we'll have the equivalent of an iPod for healthcare, which will be able to measure many of your own personal parameters and to record and keep long-term records that will give you instantaneous feedback on actions that promote wellness as opposed to disease. And I would argue this digitalization will in time have far greater consequences for society even than the digitalization of information technology and communication. And who could have imagined in 1985 that a woman in a rural village in India could use a cell phone to make a living for her family? That's the kind of revolution that I think the digitalization of medicine is going to bring to healthcare. I'm going to argue that P4 medicine will in time reach a tipping point where we can turn around the ever-escalating costs of healthcare, and even more, we can bring them down to the point where we can think about exporting them to the developing world. And this allows us the enormously exciting thought of a democratization of healthcare that was even conceivable 5 years ago to think about. And of course, why do I think that? This is the point I think most people are skeptical about. Our ability to stratify disease will let us create impedance matches perfectly for drugs so we can optimize dealing with disease. Number two, we have completely new strategies for identifying drug targets and thereby efficiently creating new drugs and drugs that will operate in the context of re-engineering disease-perturbed biological networks. Number three, the benefits of wellness are enormous. It's well known what disease costs a nation in terms of job efficiency and so forth, I think we can really turn that around. And of course, this digitalization of technologies means when we make measurements of 2,500 blood proteins in the future, maybe those individual measurements will cost a penny apiece. So the whole scale of which we can do this medicine is going to change its dimensionality. And finally, there are areas that I think verge on enormous tipping points in medicine. I think stem cells, I think the idea of really beginning to understand the basics of neurodegeneration, of looking, in fact, at the aging process. I think all of those we're going to see remarkable accomplishments over the next 10 years or so. But I'd even go a step further, and I would say the nations that adopt P4 medicine won't just deal with their healthcare problem, it will be a source of generating enormous economic opportunity in the future. One, of course, is the idea we will save on healthcare, but even more important is this really interesting idea that if we can optimize wellness, and as we move into this information-based economy, we're talented people. You want to preserve their wellness and their ability to produce and everything. That, as I said earlier, is going to make an enormous difference. And finally, it's going to create enormous industrial opportunities for the classic healthcare industry that will transform how it looks at many of these problems. But even more important, I would argue, there will emerge a wellness industry that will be even larger than the current healthcare industry. And I would argue that the major players might well not be any of those who are participating in the current wellness industry. There are two challenges to P4 medicine, technical challenges and societal challenges. And I think the societal challenges are far and away the greatest challenges that we have to deal with. I mean, we will have to change enormously the infrastructure of medicine if we are to adapt the power of P4 medicine. And how can we do that? We will have to gain access to data so we can mine for the predictive medicine of the future. And how can we do that in the context of concern about security and privacy and abuse of privacy? Those are all issues that we have to deal with. So what ISB has done really is decided on its only effective way to take on this large problem is to set up strategic partnerships that can catalyze the emergence of circumstances that will prove the worth of P4 medicine. And let me just say make one other point about ISB. We're absolutely committed to this idea I mentioned earlier of transferring knowledge to society, and we've done it in three different ways. Number one, we've created within ISB the Center for Inquiry-Based Science, and we've absolutely revolutionized K-12 science education in Seattle, and we're now reaching out across the state. Number two, we created five companies in the 10 years that ISB has been existent, and in fact, they're all doing extremely well. But one of those companies was a company called the Accelerator that's a partnership with five venture capital groups that have each invested in very early stage companies. Here we've created 12 additional companies, eight of which are really doing very well. And it's created, we've raised close to $500 million for all of these companies over that time period. And we've created close to 500 jobs in Seattle for doing that. So if you can transfer knowledge effectively, you can create enormous economic gains for the area, geographical area in which you live. And then the third thing is we're really interested in bringing science to society, and this lecture is one example of some of the kinds of things we do. Let me return to strategic partnerships and say that I'll talk about two of our strategic partnerships. So P4 medicine is a big problem in science. The problem with US government funding is it's all for small science. So about 6 years ago, I started asking my question, how could I create the resources to really be able to carry out big science effectively and in a integrative, hypothesis-driven, focused manner? So I visited five different companies making various kinds of propositions. And one of those countries, Luxembourg, we hit at exactly the right time because it had decided to diversify its economy from a dependence on financial services at the 90% level, and this was before the big break, clash, to healthcare and biotech. So we made a proposal to them where we would do a whole series of things, which I'm not going to talk about. In return, they've given us $100 million over 5 years to be able to attack two of the most fundamental problems of P4 medicine. And what this has enabled us to do is develop the tools and the ideas that you heard about earlier in this lecture. The second question was, okay, that's great. You're laying out the framework for being able to do this. How can you actually bring it to patients? And there what we've done is create a nonprofit institute called the P4 Medicine Institute that is committed to helping ISB create a small network of medical centers that will take on the ISB assays in the context of specific pilot projects. And the first medical center that we've collaborated with in this endeavor is Ohio State Medical School. And the two pilot projects that we're working on now are wellness and heart failure. For example, in wellness, we're developing a whole set of molecular and cellular metrics for assessing wellness in the individual. And the idea of the pilot projects is, if we can succeed with Ohio State and maybe four or five other institutions in different pilot projects, we'll demonstrate the power of P4 medicine to Washington, to the FDA, to the skeptical physicians and the medical community and so forth. And one of the really exciting ideas that I've negotiated is, what's unusual about Luxembourg is its population of 500,000. It is the wealthiest per capita country in the world, and it is run almost entirely by a ministry of nine, three of whom are key to the biological projects we're doing there, and all three have agreed, if we're successful over the next few years in these pilot projects, Luxembourg can become a pilot nation for P4 medicine. And what I've always been impressed with in catalyzing a realization of paradigm changes is you can't persuade people logically of their power. You have to show them you can do things you never did before. So that's really what we'd like to do here in that particular context. So let me close then quickly by making just four general points, including defining the essence of what I see as P4 medicine right now. One is quantifying wellness, and the second is demystifying disease. And I think we're well along to demonstrating the power of P4 medicine to do both of these kinds of things. So these four interesting issues I'm going to talk about. Remember I said earlier that in every case, the paradigm changes I talked about at the beginning of the lecture needed new institutions to get them to realize them. And here are all of the new institutions that got started. And I think the really interesting question is, what are the kinds of institutions that will catalyze P4 medicine? And I think that's a fascinating question to consider. Point number two is that the more I've thought about it, the more I think I'd argue, just as Thomas Friedman did in his now famous novel, The World is Flat, where he said basically education and economics can operate on a worldwide basis. National boundaries don't mean very much anymore. I'd argue in a sense that that may well be true for science as well, because I see international networks as being a very attractive way of attacking really big, hard problems in biology, like P4 medicine. I see you can, for the first time, say, who are the best people in the world to get involved in solving this problem? And as Perimeter knows well, the best people in the world are really key for solving hard problems. And the other point is it opens up new and exciting possibilities for fundraising that have never been thought about before. So I think this globalization of science is going to be a very interesting opportunity for biology in the future. And in fact, we're talking with three other countries in various ways now about creating a larger international network of P4-related interests and so forth. Let me just say a word more about big problem, big science and small science and biology. Big science, I mean hypothesis-driven, integrative, cross-disciplinary approaches to biology. I would argue, as I did earlier, that these approaches are going to be essential for handling many of the big problems that society is facing. In the US today, especially at NIH, which is run mostly by quote, small scientists, that is, individual investigators with labs of two or three people to 10 people, there is an enormous pressure afoot to do away with all big science and put all of that very modest amount of funding in small science. To give you an example, for one of the major institutes, General Medical Science at NIH, it puts 6% into big science and about 70% into small science. And I've always argued you need a mixed portfolio. It's really going to be critical to have that mixed portfolio. And how we can ensure that for the future in these hard times, I think, is going to be an enormously challenging question. I will say that Korea and China and Singapore are really putting money into facilities that will support this kind of big science in a way that's just not being done in the U.S. at all. And I think we have to think seriously about our position in terms of international competition in the future. So again, I would just remind you of what we talked about a little bit earlier. The real societal challenges in the future are these big problems, and it is going to be big science that we're going to need to attack these problems. So my very last slide is hearkening back to the implications that the Genome Project had for human life. And in taking some artistic license, I would say that there are three important implications. And the first implication is we are all one species. There are no race-specific genes. So if we differ fundamentally in our outlook toward terrorism or whatnot, it is a consequence of environmental and social inequities, whether it's jobs, whether it's health, whether it's education, or whatnot. And I've always argued that the worst way we can deal with terrorism is to go to war. We have to deal with these fundamental inequities and solve those. The second point that is really amazing from the Genome Project, and we now have probably in excess of 2,000 genomes that have been sequenced on creatures at various levels of complexity, is the incredible interconnectedness of all life. I don't see how anybody who can look objectively at these data could ever argue for a creationist point of view. But I think the implication is, as a society, we have an enormous obligation not only to leave our world livable for our children and our grandchildren, but we have an obligation to the other species to make reasonable accommodation for their needs as well. And then finally, I would say what this really means is we're going to have to be much more effective in teaching our students and our fellow citizens about science so that they can make informed decisions about the enormous challenges that society will be faced with in the next world. And I think that's an elegant and mute testimony to the power, once again, of what the Genome Project has done, not only in terms of science itself, but in terms of philosophic implications. So thank you very much. Good, thank you. Michelle. You shouldn't clap too long because we want to get to the questions next.
So where are we going first? Here we are.
Do you see a future in using something such as bacteria to store tremendous amounts of data?
So I would say where I think microbes are really going to be exciting is we can actually re-engineer their DNA to do things that are going to be useful to humankind. The bacterial DNA is relevant as a model system to understanding human DNA, higher level DNA. But I think where we're really going to be able to employ it and use it in exciting ways is to re-engineer it and create carbon compounds, create energy-relevant compounds, create compounds that let us deal with major environmental problems, CO2 production, things like that. And I think there'll be an enormous revolution in our capacity to do that.
Thank you. Question number two here on the edge.
I'd like to thank you very much for a both informative and quite an inspiring talk. There's a book on the table out there by Ray Kurzweil, and he's talking about a different aspect of things, sort of the cyborg aspect, I suppose. Do you see any connection between those two?
Well, I would say that certainly we're going to be able to engineer humans to deal in interesting ways with information, particularly once we start understanding the brain and its impedance matches better and so forth. But you know, the whole idea of cyborgs implies a rigidity that I think we want to be careful not to lose in humans. You know, I thought you were going to ask me about Ray's idea that we can live forever if we treat our bodies correct, and I'll say that's utter nonsense. There isn't a chance that I'd love it. We'd all love it, but it isn't going to happen because of I think what we can do in terms of Ray's suggestion is, I think we'll be able to optimize each of our natural lifespans by avoiding most illnesses and so forth. And I think we'll probably be able to live out our lives physically and mentally quite effective into the 80s or even into the 90s. But I still suspect we're not going to push limits beyond whatever kind of the built-in systems failures are. It's really interesting. If you look at the Greeks, the oldest Greeks could live actually about as long as the oldest people today can live. So there hasn't been any change in that total lifespan. It's just that we have many, many people living longer to those points of time. And I think we'll really, I mean, one of the really interesting societal challenges of the future is going to be if we can keep people effective and productive and creative into their 90s, how are we going to deal with the sociology of retirement and insurance and all of the, I mean, it's I think society is going to have to restructure itself in really major ways, and I think that's going to be an enormous challenge. That's a different question, I recognize. But,
let's yes. take a question on the right, my right.
How would you encourage children today, or at least parents, people our age, to encourage children in particular to be, for that spark in biology? What would you suggest how can we encourage children, not only in science, but most particularly with biology? What would be the things, especially what you're doing with the K-12 and so on?
I'll tell you, I think the key to encouraging science are teachers that are trained and passionate. So in the K-12 science program that I mentioned in Seattle that the Institute has, we focus entirely on professional teacher training. We focus on pedagogical and on content. We've actually made a series of modules on systems biology that we can insert into high school biology programs. We're doing the same for P4 medicine now. And I think what's critical to really catalyzing kids' interests is good teachers. I think we have to pay them a good salary, a lot better than we pay them in the US. I don't know what it's, and I think we have to respect them in ways we don't respect them very well. I just spoke a week ago to the school board in Renton, a city in suburbia Seattle, and talked about a systems approach to education. And the superintendent got up and said, "What is really great about what you're doing, Lee, is you respect the teachers and you make them a part of your team." And I think that's what we can do for teachers. We can make them have a sense of participating in science in a really important and fundamental way, and we can give them the support they need to be able to teach in modern, contemporary, exciting kinds of ways. I think that dwarfs everything else that I can think of.
Yes, you indicate that P4 medicine will change our lives and our society in many, many ways. I suspect that the food industry might be one of those that will be changed pretty radically, because food impacts our bodies, obviously, environmentally and biologically. Could you comment on that, please?
No, I agree with you entirely. I don't know if any of you have read, there was an article in the New York Times magazine about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, on sugar is a poison. Now, I think that's a bit excessive, but when you read that article, you realize that we are really over-sugared. And it doesn't matter whether it's natural sugar or the high corn starch kind of sugar. They have equally deleterious side effects. This fellow argues that the epidemic of type 2 diabetes could almost certainly be traced to that, and overweightness and things like that. So I think there are going to be very fundamental ways we're going to have to change our eating habits if we're going to optimize this wellness. And how you bring the food industry into that, it's not clear to me. I don't know that industry. I have no idea what it's about. But I guess the way you convince people is that change is inevitable and you can do well if you do it right. But that would take concerted efforts and program to be able to do, obviously. But I think, yeah, we are going to have to change our diets in some fundamental ways. And the question, you know, that I always get asked is, you know, everybody knows smoking is bad for you and eating too much is bad for you, yet many people don't change their behaviors. So how are you going to change people's behavior? Well, I would say two ways. One, if we can really educate kids so they understand these issues, I think that could make a big difference. But number two, if we really have these iPods for healthcare that give us instantaneous monitoring of how bad that thing we like to do is for us, I think real-time feedback could really go a long ways toward changing behavior, but we'll see.
Let's take one more question at the back.
Hi, you talked a lot about big science versus small science and the importance of pursuing big science, but you never gave an explicit definition of sort of what the difference is. So I was wondering if you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure. So small science is an individual scientist with his colleagues that operate on a problem that could be handled at the level of those resources. And big science is done by institutes like ours, where you've created a cross-disciplinary environment, where you have the technological capacity to make lots of measurements and take lots of different kinds of pictures, and where you're driving the problem by a focused integrative effort. For example, what Luxembourg has let us do is create an international network. So we have in Europe about four nodes in that network. We have across the states another three or four nodes in the network, and then we have a number of people at ISB that are working on these problems. So it's big, it's cross-disciplinary, it's integrated, and you're focusing on a single kind of coherent problem. So, and big science, once you've set up the infrastructure, can be done by 10 or 20 people, but the infrastructure requires, and I'll tell you, I think, and it's interesting challenge for universities that are serious about biology, if you don't create the infrastructure to do big science, you will in the future become significantly less competitive with the world as a whole, being led by some of the Asian countries, quite obviously. It is really important to have this mixed portfolio, and big science enables small science, and small science allows big science to solve some of its deepest and most fundamental problems at an appropriate scale. So I would say the two are enormously synergistic with one another, but you need both flavors.
And if please join me in congratulating and thanking Dr. Leroy Hood.